For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Our podcast today is sponsored by Athletic Greens. I take AG1 by Athletic Greens every day for better gut health, increased energy, and immune system support. As someone who is constantly on the go, AG1 helps me to cover my nutritional bases with a simple, tasty, easy-to-mix drink. I take AG1 in the morning, and it makes me feel ready to take on my entire day. Why take a bunch of different pills when you can just mix one scoop of powder and water once per day? AG1 was designed for ease of use, so you can live healthier and better without having to do a lot. One single serving delivers a powerful blend of vitamins, minerals, probiotics, adaptogens, and much more. If you're looking for an easier way to take supplements, Athletic Greens is giving you one free year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to athleticgreens.com/Zuby. That's athleticgreens.com/Zuby and get your free year supply of vitamin D as well as 5 free travel packs with your order. Go check it out. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunting you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a brilliant guest. He is a nephrologist, and he is also a best-selling author of several important books, including The Obesity Code and The Complete Guide to Fasting. And this is the one and only Dr. Jason Fung. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Awesome, man. It's great to have you on. Dr. Fung, for people who are not familiar with you, please tell them a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm a kidney specialist. So I basically treat a lot of dialysis patients, a lot of type 2 diabetes patients. And that's sort of where my interest in weight loss came out, because it became obvious that if you just treat the diabetes or treat the kidney failure as you get the diabetes, it's very unsatisfactory. Much better is to try to prevent the diabetes so that you never get the problems. And to do that, you have to lose weight, basically. And that's where it, you know, as I started to think about it a lot more, there was a lot of misconceptions in the treatment of obesity and how to lose weight and so on. And some of it was just very striking. For example, the treatment paradigm that most doctors get, and I got, was it's all about calories in, calories out, for example, and you just have to eat fewer calories. The problem with that, of course, is that sort of advice to cut 500 calories a day is spectacularly unsuccessful. Like, the failure rates are somewhere along the lines of 99%. So in other words, we're giving people a strategy that had a 99% failure rate. And you wonder why doctors basically don't give advice on how to lose weight. They didn't know. They didn't get the training to teach their patients. They knew that the training that they got, when they gave that advice, it almost always failed. So therefore, they just gave up. And yet, here's this condition, obesity, which contributes to type 2 diabetes, contributes to all kinds of things. We know that, right? It contributes to heart disease, contributes to stroke, contributes to cancer, contributes to like back pain and knee pain and hip replacements and all this other problems that we all face. And yet, physicians had basically given up the whole field to, like, you know, shake companies and nutritional supplement companies and Weight Watchers and that kind of thing, right? It's like, but this is a real important medical topic. So that's where I became very interested, and that's where I started talking about it. I started blogging about it, because a lot of the information that I learned was actually just like 100% wrong. Like, it was just stupid. Like, eat at the time, you got to remember this was 2014 or so, people were saying, oh, you should eat small meals through the day and, you know, eat very low fat and all this sort of, you know, so eat a lot of muffins and stuff, right? And they're low fat, right? Lots of potatoes and rice, you know, starchy, low carb, low fat foods, right? And nobody was losing weight. People were gaining weight. But it never occurred to them that, hey, you know, look at your results. Like, your results are terrible. People are getting more overweight, which is causing more health problems. So we really need to reevaluate the advice we're giving people and think about it. So I started talking about intermittent fasting, which I think is a good strategy for many people, as well as low carbohydrate diets, which I also think is a good strategy for many people. None of these things are sort of cure-alls, right? It's not some miracle thing. And sometimes people think that it should be, but, you know, it's a tool. You know, you need different tools for different people. And those are tools that we shouldn't ignore, which we were ignoring. We were basically saying that we shouldn't do it. But of course, that's the sort of background that I came from, how I became interested in the weight loss sort of puzzle.
Awesome. Before we carry on and we get into some of the intricacies of some of the things we talk about, I want to give you some flowers, Jason. I want to give you some flowers. Okay. I don't know if you know how I came across you and your work. I don't know if I don't think I've mentioned this publicly, because actually I wanted to save it for the podcast to tell you this in person. And I want to thank you, because my parents, who are in their mid-60s and 70s, they read your book, The Complete Guide to Fasting, in early 2020. At this point, my mom had been type 2 diabetic for about 4 or 5 years, and her diabetes has been in remission since 2020 after following your protocol. My mom is no longer diabetic, thanks in part to reading your book. She started fasting and completely put it in remission. She has also lost 25 plus pounds. My dad has also lost over 25 pounds, and they've both kept the weight off since 2020, and we're now in 2023, and there is a good chance that that would not have happened if it were not for your work. So personally, I want to say a massive thank you for putting this information out there, because as you know, it's helping people, but I am one of the many people, you know, indirectly, who the work has benefited, and my parents are a lot healthier now. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, that's, you know, to me, that's amazing to hear, because, you know, this is what I'm talking about, right? You give people the right information and they can do great things, right? Like, we assume people are too stupid to do anything about it themselves, right? But you give people the right information, they do it, they look after themselves, and look what happens, right? And it's crazy, because by going from diabetic to non-diabetic, you know, her risk of all these important complications has gone way down. So maybe you don't see it in the next few months, but in the next few years, clearly, it's a huge risk factor. So that was the other thing that was, I thought, was stupid, right? This is what I wrote the diabetes code about, was that, again, at the time, people were saying, every diabetes association in the world had been saying that type 2 diabetes was a chronic and progressive disease, which is saying that once you have that diagnosis, you will never undo that diagnosis. You will be type 2 diabetic forever. And as they were saying this, and I actually put it in some of my YouTube lectures, I said one of the biggest lies about type 2 diabetes is that it's chronic and progressive, because everybody knows, doctors know, patients know, everybody knows, you lose weight, that diabetes either gets better or goes away. This is type 2 diabetes. And it's like, so why are we lying that it's chronic and progressive? It's not. It's about how you treat it. And of course, the doctors were treating it with a lot of drugs. And, you know, if it's a dietary disease and you treat it with drugs, well, you're not going to reverse the disease. So I said, it's reversible, but you have to look at the right things, right? You can't use drugs for a dietary disease. You got to fix the diet. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you can put this into reverse. And of course, at the time, it was complete heresy, right? Now, of course, in 2021, every diabetes association now has criteria for remission. So it was like, you just had to give them a push in the right direction. And, you know, like you, I tend to be very blunt I came out and just said, this is stupid. It's a big lie.
Well, it's so important, you know, because in every industry and in every sector, you need people who are willing to question and challenge the orthodoxy. And I think that in the world of nutrition in particular, I mean, even over the course of my relatively short life of 30 something years, the amount of sort of the way that the general information has changed. I mean, I remember in the 90s, of course, the sort of standard US food pyramid that was pushed around the world, really, you know, super high carbs, 10, 12 servings of carbs per day, you know, very, very low fats, you know, moderate amounts of meat, protein, meat, dairy, and fruit and veg. And then I remember then it sort of switched to fat, fat was the devil. And then carbs definitely became the devil, and it became, you know, the Atkins diet and everything keto everything. And then it sort of switched into paleo, and then it switched again. And it's amazing. It's like every sort of 5 to 7 years, there's this sort of change and oftentimes complete contradiction of what was being said before. But I think that the 80s and 90s programming of animal saturated fat in general being bad, but especially animal fat and saturated fat being bad, you know, skipping meals being very bad, not eating breakfast being very bad, what other things, you know, high carbs being very, very good as long as there's low fat. All of these ideas, I think, are still so deeply ingrained in people's psyche. Even those of us who are more likely to sort of question it. I mean, for example, with seed oils, for example, are a big conversation, and it's been so put in people's brains that things like processed margarine are better and healthier than say butter, right? And if you tell someone, actually, well, you know, butter's not the devil, you know, butter is better than, you know, these trans fats and whatever, and no, people don't believe it because I think it caught so many people so young, and it's been repeated so many times, and it hasn't really been updated properly, even though there are, you know, heretics such as yourself out there saying, well, what about fasting? What about this? What about that? So there's still so much work to be done there. And I do hope that we see some generational shift in it because, I mean, just looking at the obesity rate numbers, certainly in the USA, but also in any Western developed country, pretty much in every single country, the numbers are startling. And it just, you know, the percentage of people who are obese just keeps going up and up and up. And despite us having access to so much information and so many people, it still seems like that's something that needs to be put in remission on a societal level. Because at the rate it's going, I mean, you know, it's going to be like 90% obesity rate or something within a few decades if it keeps going as the way it's going.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot there. I mean, there was always two sort of important issues. One is the diet, that is the foods that you eat. And, you know, there's always debates about that. I think that for the most part, it does change every couple of years, right? But it's, you know, if you get back to sort of traditional foods, you probably can't go too wrong. And that's one of the things that we have to always keep in mind. I think that was one of the good things about sort of paleo movement and, you know, whole food plant-based. It's not plant-based because, of course, there was this automatic assumption. I remember thinking this many, many years ago, that if you're plant-based, you automatically must be skinny. And it's like, it's not true at all, of course, right? You could eat chocolate donuts all day long and vegetarian pizza, not very good for you and quite fattening, you know, French fries and pizza and chocolate donuts, right? You'd gain a lot of weight if that's all you ate was pizza and donuts. So there's nothing automatically healthy about a vegetarian diet, but it's, you know, now you're starting, then you add whole foods, and as soon as you start doing that, it's good, right? It probably is quite good. Paleo, same thing, eat natural foods. Keto originally was eat natural foods, then it just sort of became, you know, just high fat and mm-hmm. processed foods, right? So but that's sort of one issue which gets a lot of play. What a lot of people hadn't talked about for a long time was also the timing of the meals, right? So should you eat six times a day, eight times a day. Because if you remember about 7 or 8 years ago, that was the prevailing orthodoxy. When I started saying that, you know, well, you shouldn't really be eating all the time. Like, you can have a period of fasting. It's normal. It's natural. That's where the word breakfast comes in, right? It breaks your fast. It means you have to fast, right? It was like people went crazy. They're like, oh no, you need to eat every like 1.5 to 2 hours. I'm like, okay, but you know that before like 1990, like nobody did that, right? Like zero people did that because there just wasn't the same amount of snacking back then. It wasn't easily available. Like, you know, nobody had it around, so you didn't eat it. And you're fine. You could go from lunch to dinner, you know, without keeling over. Like, it's possible, right? and somehow we went from, you know, the 70s and 80s, for example, where, you know, if you wanted an after-school snack, your mom would say, no, you're going to ruin your dinner. And if you wanted a bedtime snack, your mom would say, no, you should have ate more at dinner. To, you need a after-school snack and you need the bedtime snack, right? And, you know, it's like even in the schools, for example, you get these notes, please send 2 snacks with your kids. I'm thinking, why? Are they not eating lunch or am I not feeding them dinner? Which one is it, right? Tell me, because why am I giving them 2 snacks? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when they play sports and, you know, parents think, oh, you have to give them a snack, right, in between while they're playing sports. I'm like, why? They're not hungry. They're not thirsty. So it's a very interesting sort of this change, and nobody really, it's kind of snuck in there without anybody knowing. But yeah, absolutely, there is a lot of changes that we need to make about, hey, the human body is quite amazing. We are able to store energy, food energy, with just calories, which means that you don't have to eat constantly because your body has energy stores. So if you don't eat, you're going to take that energy stores back out of body fat, right? So if you're trying to lose 100 pounds, that's like 350,000 calories of energy sitting on your body. Why does it matter if you eat that muffin in the morning? Because if you don't eat that muffin, you know, the 300 calories of muffin in the morning, your body will take that 300 calories out of your body fat stores. And I would rather that happen than you take that muffin, right? So the whole thing was kind of nonsensical. And there's still a lot of opposition against fasting. I'm thinking, okay, think about this. Fasting is just any period of time that you're not eating. So if you're against fasting, you think that you need to eat the minute you get up until the minute you go to bed. Now, keep in mind that when you're eating, your body is going to store calories. That's what you're telling the body to do when you put that food in your mouth, because food goes in, your body's like, well, I have more than enough right now, so I'm going to put it in storage, right? So, you know, just flip it on its head, right? If you're against fasting, you're pro constant eating. Mm-hmm. Constant eating equals weight gain. There's just no way around it. It is actually completely impossible for you to lose weight while you are putting food in your mouth. It does not happen. The only way you actually lose body fat is to not eat so that your body will take the energy back out. Mm-hmm. So if you're constantly eating, not going to work, right? But of course, you know, again, like you said, you repeat something often enough. Oh, you have to eat breakfast. Oh, you must snack. Oh, you have to. Pretty soon everybody accepts it as true, even though the logic of it is completely, you know, like there's no logic in it, right? You have to eat to lose weight. Well, no, you can't eat and lose weight. You have to not eat to lose weight. That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting because I've had a fairly unique journey over the past 2 decades with this stuff. So I got into the gym early. I mean, I started training seriously when I was 15. And so I was really into bodybuilding, and particularly even more so than in the general world, but in the world of bodybuilding and fitness in general, it was like, yeah, you need to eat every 2 to 3 hours, otherwise you're going to go catabolic. That was always the thing every young man who was trying to build muscle was worried about, you know, that you go catabolic after 2 hours and your body starts consuming your muscle mass if you don't eat for 2 to 3 hours. So myself and loads of my friends who were, you know, 15, 16, we were just pounding calories. We were just eating all day long. It didn't matter if we weren't hungry, just every 2 to 3 hours on the clock, making sure you're eating, making sure you're getting your 30 grams of protein. This is also when they were saying, you know, you can't digest more than 30 grams of protein at a time. So if you're going to hit that 1 gram per pound of body weight, then you have to spread it across 5, 6, 7 different meals during the day. And I believed this until my early 20s. So I came across intermittent fasting early, actually. I started intermittent fasting in 2009, and this was with Martin Berkhan's leangains.com. So I came across this website, which was countering absolutely everything that was like the common orthodoxy in bodybuilding, especially. This is a guy saying, you know, you can just eat 1 or 2 meals a day in a very short, in a relatively short window, you know, 4 to 8 hour window. You can digest way more than 30 grams of protein in one sitting. You don't need to be feeding yourself all the time. So I remember reading this and just thinking like, what on earth? Like, this is completely counterintuitive to everything I've learned. And also, you know, I had made good progress with eating 5, 6 meals a day. The problem was that I was always hungry, especially if I was trying to diet down. But you know, I'd built up a good amount of muscle mass and strength, and my athletic ability was good. And I've never been a big on, you know, just pounding junk food. So I was still eating good food. I was just eating way more than I needed to. And I was thinking about food as a result, way more than I needed to, because I'm constantly thinking, okay, I need to eat every 2, 3 hours. I need to plan the next meal. So I was reading this guy's blog and his site. Again, this is 2009. And I was like, all right, let me give this a shot, because I wanted to lean down for a summer. And I was like, all right, I'm going to try this intermittent fasting thing. I think it was the 16-8 protocol. So that's 16 hours fasting and then an 8 hour eating window. And it worked. I mean, other diets I'd done before had worked, but with this one, I was like, I'm not even hungry. That was the difference. Like, before, I'd be ravenously hungry if I was trying to cut down. And with this, I was just like, oh wow, I can just eat, you know, twice a day and I'm fine. I got down to doing, you know, just kind of a 5 or 6 hour window and then fasting for 18, 19 hours a day. And it was totally fine. And I think even more so at that time, I think now people have at least heard of intermittent fasting, but even in 2009, it was like, I remember even telling people about it, and it was just like, no, like, that's, especially bodybuilding bros, it was just like, dude, like, you're gonna lose all your muscle mass, you're gonna lose all your gains and so on. So actually now for me, for 13, 14 years, I've mostly done intermittent fasting. If I'm switching time zones a lot or I'm traveling constantly, then I'm not too dogmatic with it. But I typically still have around an 8 hour eating window, sometimes 6, sometimes 7. And I've kept that up for well over a decade at this point. So for anyone who has not tried intermittent fasting, even if you're doing it that sort of style, you know, not even doing 24 hours or multiple days, then even that, it just, for me, the big thing actually was just the life simplification. That was one of the biggest things for me, just being far more conscious of what and when I was consuming, and then just not having this constant concern about needing to eat even when I'm not hungry and I don't feel like it. And so now when I eat, you know, I eat and I feel satisfied, and I generally eat, you know, until I'm pretty full. And then I do that pretty much twice a day and I'm good to go.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, actually, because that was, you know, a lot of that same advice. My core audience is sort of older, right? It's mostly sort of older people who have type 2 diabetes or obese and trying to lose weight. But it was the same thing. They had the same problem, right? They're getting this advice that you have to, and you look at some of these diet plans, right? And it's like, you know, like a breakfast and then a mid-morning snack and then a lunch and then a snack and then a dinner and then a snack and then another snack. And people are constantly thinking about what to eat. And then when they actually eat their meal, instead of eating until they're full, you know, the meal was like, you know, 3 pieces of lettuce, right? And it's like, oh, that's all you get, right, for lunch. And it's like, because you're going to get a snack. So, you know, to me, it was complete, like, people were going crazy on this because they're like, okay, now it's a huge chore to plan your whole day because you're thinking about the 7 or 8 meals that you have to have, and they're going crazy. And the other thing, of course, is this whole idea that you should eat a little bit and then stop is again, it's stupid. Because if you think about it, what you know, increases your appetite? Well, we have things called appetizers, which are small portions that are not enough to make you completely full, but enough to get your saliva going, to for you to be thinking about food. So if you're going to eat an appetizer for breakfast because you're eating a small meal, right? Now you're going to stimulate your hunger. And before you actually get full, you're going to stop. Okay, that's a lot of willpower. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to do that again in the mid-morning. Then you're going to do that again at lunch, right? You're going to have, you know, a little bit of bread and then stop. So now you're hungry, but you're going to stop eating because that's what the meal plan told you to do, right? These 6 small meals, 8 small meals a day, right? So you're constantly stimulating your hunger and not satisfying it. And it's like, well, no wonder everybody's going crazy with these diets, because the way it's structured is completely opposite to the way that we sort of have historically eaten, which is you have your meal time, which is breakfast, lunch, and dinner, say, or just lunch and dinner for people who don't eat breakfast. You eat until you're full, and that gets you to the next meal. And then dinner takes you right through to the next day, sort of thing, right? And not this sort of constant grazing. I remember one of the first meetings I went to with one of these nutrition meetings, people were like, you know, you could graze all the time if you want to look like a cow. It's like, yeah, that is really true. And, you know, the other thing I thought was funny about intermittent fasting, now that you brought it up, was that some of the very first people to seriously embrace it were actually the bodybuilders, because you have this interesting sort of dual mandate, one, to build muscle, but two, to lose body fat, right? Because you have to be very lean in order to show off your muscles, which is different than, say, weight training, like, you know, the World's Strongest Man competitions. Mm-hmm. None of them are very lean, right? They're generally very big because, you know, if you eat a lot, you can get a little strong, right? So the you know, that was interesting to me because it showed people, I guess, that no, you didn't have to lose muscle to gain that. There's a balance there that you can get with intermittent fasting. But again, there's so many benefits. It simplifies your life. And again, people, you know, you've kept it up for 6 or 9, 10, 11, 12 years. And people always say, you know, it's a fad diet. It's like, you know, they talk about it in every religion, many which are thousands of years old, right? So even if you take the, you know, Catholic religion, it's like, you know, they talk about it in the Bible, right? And so it's we at least have 2,023 years of experience with fasting. It's not a fad.
Yeah.
Literally millions of people have done it over their entire lives. So no, it's not much of a fad. Same with 3 meals a day. Like our grandparents did it sort of every day of their life, you know, didn't, you know, routinely have snacks. They did it for like their whole life. It's not, you know, it's not something crazy, right? It's literally the oldest intervention. So I think a lot of that has, you know, that was a lot of what I was talking about in the Complete Guide to Fasting and the Obesity Code was, hey, you know, we have this tool for weight loss, for reversing type 2 diabetes, because, you know, when you think about it, you know, we overcomplicate things, right? So if you think about how the body works, the body has 2 different fuels that it can use. It can use sugar, which is glucose, which is carbs, or it can use fat. And when it stores energy, you can store it as glucose or you can store it as fat. So if you want to, if you have a disease where you have too much glucose, like type 2 diabetes, or if you have a disease where you have too much body fat, like obesity, well, just let your body use it up, right? That's fasting. That's basically what it does. And you know, why wouldn't you use it, right? So it's a really interesting sort of, you know, change in the way people have seen things. And, you know, some of the pioneers like Martin Birkin and stuff, they've been great. They were, you know, a little bit different audience than I was sort of targeting, but certainly made a huge difference in terms of that, those populations and bringing it into the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's interesting, and funnily enough, this goes for more than the issues of, you know, obesity and some of the related, you know, metabolic syndrome and other problems with that, is the actual anomaly and aberration is really the period from the 90s until the early 2020s, if you think about it. I mean, all throughout history, like you said, you know, this constant grazing, constant snacking, this is not how human beings would have eaten. It was more of a, you know, feast and fast. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes famine. But, you know, it's only sort of this 30-year or so period where all of these new ideas, you know, based in oftentimes just advertising and PR campaigns, if we're being honest, but then backed by, you know, bogus science and funded studies from certain organizations, have sort of programmed so many hundreds of millions of people to think that, you know, again, whether you're just an average person or you're even a bodybuilder or an athlete, you've been programmed with this idea that you need to wake up and, you know, wake up and eat. The thought of even waking up and eating something immediately makes me feel like gross. Like I travel all the time, and I stay at hotels and whatever. And, you know, they serve breakfast from like 6 a.m. till 9 a.m. And you know, like these American breakfasts as well, it's like 6:30 in the morning and people are there like eating pancakes with like syrup and this and this. And I'm just like, how are you eating that at 6:30 a.m.? I mean, you clearly don't need it. Again, I'm looking at the person thinking, you're not, you know, you've got quite a lot of stored, you've got a lot of stored energy on your body quite clearly. And they'll do that. And then, you know, by the time I'm having my first meal, they might be on their third or on their fourth. And I'm just thinking, man, that's such an anomaly. And when you break away from the programming and you do think about it, and this is the moment I had when I first discovered intermittent fasting, I was like, that doesn't really make sense, does it? You know, the idea that your body can only process 30 grams of protein in a sitting. Yeah. I was like, that doesn't make sense. The idea that my body's going to start cannibalizing my lean body mass if I don't eat for 3 hours. Like, if you think about it, even though I'd accepted this because the magazine said so, when I really thought about it, I was like, that's so stupid. Like, that does not even, that doesn't make sense. Like, why would a human body start cannibalizing itself after 3 hours? We're not even saying 3 days or 3 months and why would it eat my muscle first?
Right? Exactly.
It doesn't actually make sense.
Yeah, that's what I always said. Because I always said, like, look, your body is going to store energy as glucose or fat. Mm. And, you know, if you think that the body will start burning functional tissue, like, the human body has to be incredibly stupid, right, to store energy as fat. And the minute you need it to start burning muscle, why would it do that, right? How would we have survived? Right? You think about all those native peoples, you know, cavemen and cavewomen, there's feast and famine. So if you, you know, store fat and then burn muscle, you should have like these little giant blobs of fat running around the American plains, right? But they're not, right? All these traditional peoples, you know, cavemen, they're lean, right? They're muscular. There's no fat, right? So it's like, it's obviously wrong because the human body's not that stupid, right? It's like, you know, storing firewood for the winter ahead. And as soon as it gets cold, you chop up your sofa. It's like, no, you're not going to do that. And this idea that you need to fuel yourself for the day ahead, I mean, that gets repeated so often, but it's actually completely false too. Because again, you think about it, what happens in the body is that at around 4 a.m., there's a circadian rhythm, which is this natural rhythm of hormones that goes up and down. And at around 4 a.m., the hormones that go up are, you know, growth hormone and sympathetic nervous system. It's getting you ready for the day ahead. And it's pushing glucose into your system. So you actually can see this sometimes. It's called the dawn phenomenon. So your glucose, your blood glucose level is low at night, and then it pops up a little bit in the early morning. And that's natural. So your body has actually started to fuel yourself from your own stores. So no, You do not need to put a muffin in your mouth in order to have energy for the day ahead. You're already getting that energy from your body fat stores, from your blood glucose stores, which if your blood glucose levels are high, is a very, very good thing, right? Mm. Instead, we tell people, no, you got to eat a muffin, right? It's like, it's so silly. I mean, and you think about all those people, particularly in like, you know, in North America, we think, oh, you have to eat this big American breakfast. But, you know, in Italy, for example, their breakfast is like a little espresso, right? It's not even very much liquid. It's like, whoop, that's it, right? It's like, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And the same thing, and you're absolutely right that this is very recent thing, and it's coincided with this big spike in obesity. Like, we worry so much that if people don't eat, they're going to do irreparable harm to themselves. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I, as a doctor, had been telling people to fast all the time, because if you have, you know, if you have to go for surgery, you have to fast. If you have surgery, you have to fast. If you go for colonoscopy, you have to fast. If you do fasting blood work, you have to fast. So all along, I'm telling people to fast for this, fast for that, because, you know, and nothing bad happens. Nothing bad ever happens, right?
Yeah.
So at the same time as we are saying that it's so harmful to fast, doctors all over the world are telling, oh, you need to fast for your blood work tomorrow, or you need to fast for your colonoscopy, or you need to do this, right? So it doesn't make sense. And, you know, you think back again to the 70s, and, you know, people are eating dinner at 6 p.m. They're eating breakfast at 8 a.m. That's like 14 hours of fasting every single day without even thinking about it. And if you were a bad boy and got sent to bed without dinner, you're fasting for 20 hours, right? We think we can't go 2 hours, and kids all over the place were going 20 hours, right?
Yeah.
And nothing bad was happening. Like, everybody survived. Everybody did fine, right? So it was complete nonsense, right, when you think about it. You really had to – but somebody had to think about it and say, look, I hear what you're telling me, and I've heard it thousands of times before. But, like, yeah, somebody has to say, I'm, like, calling bullshit on it, right, because it makes zero sense to me. It just, there's no logic in the whole thing.
Well, yeah, you say that. What's interesting is it makes perfect sense if you think of the financial and profit incentives of encouraging people to believe all of these things, to believe that you're going to start, that you're going to starve to death if you don't eat for 2 or 3 hours, or that your body's going to cannibalize your muscle, to believe that you need, 30 grams of protein every couple hours, to believe that, you know, fasting is horribly detrimental, to believe that you need to eat so many snacks all throughout the day. I mean, it's fantastic. Let's be honest. It's fantastic for the food industry. It's fantastic for if you're growing all of these crops, or you're selling corn, or you're selling soybeans or vegetable oils, it's great. It's probably good for some of these pharmaceutical companies as well, right? I mean, fasting, the biggest problem with fasting, let's be honest, is it's not profitable. there's no money at all. I mean, there's no money to be made from fasting. There's no money to be made by prescribing fasting, for recommending it. The last thing a snack food or a fast food company wants is for people to be fasting. Like, it's horrible for them. I think that's just the reality of it. I think it's simply incentives.
Yeah. And unfortunately, what's happened, of course, is that a lot of those incentives have found their way into academic medicine. Mm. And we know this like 100%. We have tons of studies on it. Like, whoever funds the study always finds results that are favorable to that study. So, in fact, you look at studies of breakfast, and if you look at the ones that are funded by Kellogg, all of them show that you must eat breakfast, right?
No way. I can't believe it.
I know. And the ones that don't show it, that are not funded, show, hey, there's not really any difference. You can eat it or you cannot eat it. You can take it or leave it, yeah. Right? But the problem is that, and it's the same for academic, faculties everywhere. And Coke got sort of caught doing this. They gave, like, millions of dollars to fund research showing that sugar wasn't that bad for you. And of course, what they do is they give their dollars for the academic prestige. It happened at the University of Colorado, for example. So they're giving money to fund research. But of course, the funding person winds up playing a huge role in what those results are. And that's always true. So you can't go out there. Like if Coke wants to do a study to show that you have sugar's good for you or sugar's not bad for you. Well, nobody's going to believe it if they say Coke researchers show that Coke is not bad for you, right? So they can't do that. So instead they give lots and lots of money. And it's not just Coke, obviously. It's all the food companies. Give a lot of money to academic researcher and say University of Colorado or Harvard, whatever. So sugar researchers did this in the 70s. They gave these researchers like a lot of money, the sugar associations, and, you know, they showed that sugar was safe for you, right? They're getting a lot of money to say that, right? So then the problem is, of course, then all these academic centers, and you know, to a large extent, these academic centers are so blinded by those dollars, they don't even see the conflicts of interest anymore. Mm. They just see that, hey, you know, we need the money from here. And they're so used to getting the money from it, they don't even see that there is a problem anymore with accepting that money. So they continue to accept the money, of course, and they continue to produce research showing that, hey, you know, it's about calories. And calories is the favorite whipping boy because, you know, nobody's company is called Calories, right? It's you know, the beef associations want beef to be healthy, and the corn association wants the corn to be healthy, and the sugar association wants the sugar to be healthy. So they'll give money. So then they're all like, let's just blame it on calories, because then we're all good, right? Because then you could eat sugar instead of an egg, and as long as it's the same calories, it's the same thing. And again, that's so stupid, right? Like if you take 100 calories of cookies and 100 calories of an egg, the minute you put it in your mouth, the body responds completely differently. And we know this, completely respond differently to the cookie than the egg, right? Hormones go up, hormones go down. The point is that that makes a big difference in terms of influencing your blood sugars, your weight gain, weight loss, that kind of thing, right? Because if you take in 100 calories, your body can either store it or it can burn it. Which one it does is very important. If, for example, you take the cookie, you take 100 calories of cookies, your insulin spikes way up. You take that 100 calories, you shove it into storage, right? Glucose or body fat. Well, you've taken those calories, but it's gone straight into storage. You don't have any energy to use. So you're going to go out and eat some more because you need energy for your daily activities, right? Because you took it and shoved it immediately into storage. If you eat an egg, well, insulin doesn't go up. So you actually have energy available to use. So you're not going to be hungry. You're not going to go look for food. And that makes a big difference, of course. So, you know, this idea that it's all about calories winds up being the favorite whipping boy of all, you know, all the associated, they can all agree that let's blame it on calories, right? Let's just call it calories. And that way the sugar people are happy. The beef people are happy. The butter people are happy. The pasta people are happy. Everybody's happy as long as you do it. So then all of academic medicine goes out there and say, it's all about calories. Anybody who says different is has their head stuck in the sand. It's like, oh, you're thinking about this so incorrectly, but you don't even know because you're so sort of in that sort of echo chamber. That's why they're so unsuccessful, these academic medicine people. They're all about calories in, calories out, and you know, they don't look at the sort of intricacies of the diet. They try and break it all down to the calories. Your body has no idea how many calories you eat, right?
Is that accurate? I mean, because this is one thing where, because I also I am a big fan of the calories in, calories out. I don't think it's the be all end all, but I think that tons of people are consuming. I mean, when you say something like the body doesn't know how many calories it's eating, I mean, is that is that What do you mean by that exactly? Because that doesn't sound like an accurate statement to me.
Yeah, so your body doesn't count calories, right? Okay. So it depends on the hormone. So if, when you eat, you will produce satiety hormones, which tell you to stop eating. It's mm-hmm. not calories. So if you eat protein, for example, at some point you have to stop eating protein because there's a satiety hormone called peptide YY. If you eat, fat, your cholecystokinin will go up, which will tell you to stop eating. So your body actually has no idea when to stop eating. That's why you could drink sugar because it has no satiety value. You could drink Coca-Cola, for example, and never get full because you never activate those satiety mechanisms. So your body doesn't actually count those calories. And the thing about calories is sort of like first level thinking. Like if you say that most people who are gaining weight are taking in more calories than they're expending, well, that's true, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea is that, in order to lose weight, it doesn't simply mean you have to eat fewer calories. So if you cut 500 calories from your diet and you cut it by eating, cutting out the fat, eating very low fat, high carb foods and eating constantly, well, what happens is that your body winds up burning fewer calories. So if you want to lose weight, so say you have 2000 calories in, 2000 calories out. Now you want to lose weight. So you cut out the fat and you eat six times a day and you take 1500 calories, right? Your body very soon will burn 1500 calories. So therefore your weight loss actually stops because you sort of didn't adjust the hormones properly because, it really depends on whether you can gain access to your body fat stores, right? So suppose you have access to your body fat stores. You're taking in 2000, you're burning 2000. Now you eat 1500, but you make up the 1500 from your body fat, right? Now you have 2000. Now you can burn 2000. So that's all good. Now you're losing body fat. You're maintaining your metabolic rate. However, what is it that allows you to access the body fat? And it turns out the hormone insulin. If insulin levels are high, you can't access those body fat stores, right? So if you're injecting people with insulin, such as with diabetes, you can't access those body fat stores because insulin is high. In science, we say it's all about insulin inhibits lipolysis, right? It blocks the burning of body fat. Insulin tells your body to store energy. So if it's high, you want to store energy, not burn it. If you allow those insulin levels to fall, such as with intermittent fasting, such as with low carbohydrate diets, but there's lots of different ways to do it.
Mm-hmm. Strength training.
Then you're going to be able to take the body fat out. So you're going to be able to make up that 1500. If you don't allow the insulin levels to fall, your eating goes down from 2000 to 1500. Well, you have no access to body fat stores. In the energy balance equation, you have to balance that. If you're taking in 1500 and you want to burn 2000, where's that extra 500 going to come out of? Mm-hmm. If you can't get it out of your stores, well, you can't. So therefore, to balance that equation, your body must burn 1500 calories. That's why just cutting calories by themselves is sort of a mug's game. It doesn't work if you do it all wrong.
Okay. I think maybe the reason why this sounds odd to me is because I'm athletic and I've been strength training for so long. It seems to be obviously strength training and having a lot of lean body mass massively increases insulin sensitivity, which is, I think, something that maybe is not common knowledge. So what I certainly find, and I guess in my experience as well, personally, and with other people I've worked with, is that calories in, if you're strength training and you've got a solid amount of lean body mass, then I found simple caloric manipulation to be extremely effective for myself and other people I've worked with. I can understand that if someone is more sedentary and they don't have an above average level of lean body mass, and especially if they've already kind of broken their sort of metabolic processes through years or even decades of poor eating, then their insulin sensitivity is going to be very low. And so therefore their metabolism is more likely to downshift as a result of So for if I take myself, if I cut 500 calories out my diet, my metabolism does not downshift much at all. But that could be, I might be more of an anomaly here because I've been active and training for such a long time and I've built a lot of muscle mass, but I don't know what your thoughts are on that. Yeah, essentially, is there a big difference here between athletes and non-athletes perhaps?
Yeah, there is, because if you cut out 500 calories and you're very insulin sensitive, then your insulin levels go down, right? When your insulin levels go down, you'll pull 500 calories from your body fat mm-hmm. to make up the 2000, and your metabolic rate's not going to go down.
Yeah.
Right. So there is going to be a big difference if you're very active versus if you're not active. Mm. But the simple sort of advice for most, you know, relatively sedentary older people just to cut 500 calories is that that's not sufficient to actually cause any weight loss, because most of the studies, almost all the studies actually, show that decrease in metabolic rate as you go. So that's the problem with just doing that as an intervention about just calories. Because, you know, my argument has always been that it's really about the hormonal state and not just about the calorie state, right? The calories is sort of like, you know, there's a balance equation. And that always has to be true. But focusing in just on the calories is sort of just the sort of first step in it, because you're not looking at the sort of fundamental reasons why people are eating more calories, for example, or why their metabolic rate is not going up, for example. And that always winds up being calories, right? It's like, if you look at why people eat, it's like, well, if you're more hungry, you're going to eat, right? And that's going to come down to hormones and satiety hormones, right? So, you know, is the problem really calories, or is the problem with satiety, right? If you're eating very processed foods that have no satiety value, you're going to wind up eating more.
Yeah.
So yes, you are eating more, but there's a reason why. It's sort of like the one level deeper, why are you eating more?
Wouldn't it be fair to say that it's both? Because we have the standard law of thermodynamics, but then also, of course, depending on what foods you're putting in your mouth, from the macro to the micronutrients to the actual foods themselves to even things like, you know, how much water they have in them. We all know that, you know, fresh fruit is more satisfying than dried fruit, for example. Then that's going to have an impact on your satiety, and naturally as a result, it's going to affect how much and how often you eat. If you're eating a diet that's, you know, full of whole foods, when I say whole foods, I mean things that, you know, don't have ingredient lists for people listening, or, you know, things that grow out the ground, things your ancestors would recognize, then it's a lot harder to overeat those. They tend to be a lot more satisfying. Whereas if you're just eating processed garbage and eating everything out of a box and, you know, jacked up with sugars and vegetable oils and high fructose corn syrup, all that stuff, it's designed to be addictive, but it's not designed to be particularly satiating. And so it's way easier as a result to go overboard on them. And also you're not getting all the nutrients and everything that you should be getting. So I think your body probably, I imagine, will send some signals telling you that you're still, even though you're eating a lot, you're still deficient in various things, which is going to even want, you know, your body's going to want you to eat even more to try to get those vitamins and minerals.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's both because the types of food, like the total amount of calories does matter in a sense, because it is one of the variables in the energy balance equation. But to me, the more important thing is the sort of the quality of that, right? Because eating cookies versus eating salad, even if they're the same number of calories, they're quite different, right? And this was the whole thing when people kept saying a calorie is a calorie, and you'd hear stuff. I remember reading something about a doctor who said you could eat ice cream for dinner, right? It's like, because it's the same, you know, if you ate, a dinner of 1,000 calories with salmon and salad, you could eat 1,000 calories of ice cream and be the same. It's like, it's nowhere close to the same, right? The hormonal response to that is completely different, right? And that's the point, right? Say you take the ice cream for dinner, all of that goes directly into your fat stores because insulin has spiked way up, which it doesn't with the salmon. Mm-hmm. Now you're left looking for more calories because, hey, your body's like, I have no calories. All the calories you ate just went into the storage, right? Mm. Sort of like if you go to the grocery store, put everything into the fridge right away, put it into the freezer. It's like, well, I have nothing to eat. And it's like, so you're going to go to the store again, right? Same thing, right? So you eat that ice cream for dinner. All of a sudden, you're looking for more food. So in the end, it's going to lead to more calories, yes. But the question is really the quality of those calories. Like, what is it? It's, you know, what I say is that food sort of contains both energy, which is the number of calories, but also the instructions as to what to do with those calories, which is the hormonal response. And that's as important as the total number of calories, because what you do with those calories, what your body does with those calories is important, because if it goes directly into fat stores, then obviously you're going to gain fat. So you can't ignore one for the other. And for a long time, people had been saying, no, it's just calories, calories, calories. That's all that's important, right? And I'm saying, no, that's not all that's important. It's a part of it, but there's more to it than that, right? There's what you're eating. There's the timing of your foods. Because even if you look at hunger, if you don't eat, your hunger, you know, it goes up, but then eventually just goes back down, right? Because your body has taken the energy it needs. Therefore, the hunger goes away. So a lot of there's a lot more to it. You have to understand sort of what the physiology of it, what the hormones are doing, as opposed to simply just saying, well, you know, count your calories and cut your calories. And the problem with that, of course, is that everybody's done it and it hasn't really worked very well for the overall population. It's not that calories are unimportant. They are important in that it is a source of energy. That's what calories are. But more to the point, like, what are you doing with those calories, right? Are you storing it or are you using it, right? That's the idea.
Yeah. I think something interesting that's actually happened here, and maybe this is why these conversations can be a bit confusing, is I think that a lot of stuff from the world of bodybuilding, sports, and athletics in general actually has been sort of adopted by a general population that's not very active. So, you know, the sort of if it fits your macros idea is very much from, like, you know, bodybuilding, especially in the 2000s. It kind of came from these internet forums where, you know, if you're a young man who's in the gym lifting weights 4 or 5 times a week and you're, you know, training, burning all, you know, building up your lean body mass, your body can kind of turn into a furnace. You know, my body's like a furnace these days, right? It just kind of, I could eat that 1,000 calories of ice cream every single day and I don't get fat, right? And I'm not someone who even naturally, I've never been skinny a day in my life, right? I mean, when 20 years ago, I weighed more 20 years ago than I weigh now, right? I was overweight as a teen. But now the way my body responds to food and even quote unquote junk food, again, as long as it's like in, you know, I wouldn't base my entire diet around it, but it's my body's a lot more forgiving, I think, than the average person's is because of all the time I spend in the gym and all my training and whatever. But I guess I am aware myself, at least, even as someone who, you know, a lot of people ask for advice on training and diet, I'm aware that the average person, the average Brit or the average American or the average Canadian or whatever, is not lifting all the weights that I'm lifting and training the way that they don't have my level of insulin sensitivity. They also don't have a decade plus of mostly doing intermittent fasting, which I guess is, I don't know exactly what's going on within my body, but I'm aware that it's not like, it's not average. It's not the norm. So I'm quite cautious personally, that just because if something works for me, that doesn't necessarily mean it's great advice for someone who's sitting in an office 8 hours a day and is not lifting weights and doesn't have, you know, a lower body fat percentage and a lot of muscle and whatever. So I think maybe that's where some of the confusion has happened, because I think those ideas, you know, if it fits your macros, you know, just, you know, a calorie is a calorie. A lot of that stuff is, it's a lot more relevant to people who are just very, very active or have significantly above average levels of lean body mass compared to fat mass and so on. But I think that it's a bad idea for the general population to adopt those beliefs. Just like, again, if you're, you know, if you're eating six, seven meals a day thing, I mean, most bodybuilder bros honestly still do that and they look fine and it works fine for them. But if you're the average Joe and you start adopting those same eating patterns, then yeah, you're gonna get fat because you don't have anything counteracting that constant flood of calories that you're getting. And your body's obviously not going to turn it into lean body mass because you're not even giving it the physical training stimulus in order for it to do so.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it really depends on your situation. But this idea that a calorie is a calorie for people who are very highly active, it's probably true, right? Yeah. Because you're just going through so many.
It just goes through, yeah.
It just goes through you. So it really matters very little if you're taking a lot of carbs, like they used to carb load. Remember that whole, you know, in the 90s, it's like all about carb loading. Well, it's funny, of course. I don't know if you remember, but I used to be really into like triathlon and stuff. So this was in the 80s and 90s. So carb loading was, so I did my share of carb loading. It was, you know, before a meal, you'd carb load. And then, of course, you started hearing about bonking. I don't know if we're still talking about this, but that was a term in triathlon where your body is just completely runs out of fuel and you can barely walk. Mm-hmm. It's because you're so fueled up on carbs, you couldn't actually access your body fat.
Yeah, they called bonking, just to be clear, that was when someone's completely ran out of glycogen, right?
Completely ran out of glycogen and had no ability to switch over to sort of fat metabolism as a source of energy. So there's a famous one where some triathlete, I can't remember, she's crossing the finish line on her hands and knees because she actually just completely ran out of energy. So now we talk about metabolic flexibility, which is being able to use glucose and being able to use body fat. But I totally agree with you, right? I mean, at that level, your calories are probably, you know, not the most important issue there. It changes. And I think that's where I get, you know, a lot of pushback from people because they're like, well, you know, it works for these people, but it's like, well, most of my audience is not working out, right? They have to really watch not just the number of calories, but they also have to watch very carefully where they're getting those calories and what those are, because it is going to make a big difference. Same with type 2 diabetes, right? Like, you know, this was this is where the sort of destructive ideas come in that, hey, you can eat 500 calories and it doesn't matter where you get those calories, as long as it's 500 calories. But if you eat 500 calories of white bread, your sugar is going to skyrocket. There's no question, because white bread is amylose, which is chains of glucose. You eat glucose, your blood glucose goes up. You eat 500 calories of an egg. Well, it's protein and fat. So your blood glucose doesn't go up. Well, it's the same number of calories. But in one situation, your sugar goes way up. The other situation, it doesn't. So for a type 2 diabetic, it's incredibly important where you're getting those calories from. So this idea that a calorie, or, you know, it all comes down to calories, it's like, that's not the question. It's like, the question is, what is it doing to your body, right? And that's where the macros, and I'm not a general fan of macros either, because again, it's a bit of an unnatural, it's not always easy. If you're eating natural foods, you never really know what your macro breakdown is, right? Because how much fat a piece of meat contains depends on how much fat there is, but you don't know. Like, it's not on a label, right? You have different grades of beef, some well marbled, some not so well marbled, right? So you just don't know. So it's very difficult to do from a real practical standpoint. But again, the point being that, hey, you know, calories do affect the body differently depending on what they are. And that's, you know, an important concern for many people. Again, that's why I wind up getting into trouble with a lot of sort of bodybuilders. They're like, oh, the calories. It's like, yeah, you're probably right for you.
Yeah,
it's probably just completely different for my patient, who's like a 65-year-old, 300-pound person who barely even walks, right? So it does make a difference.
I think what you're talking about. Yeah, I think something else that also gets mixed up as well, a part that gets left out of the conversation, is, of course, you know, with calories, or, you know, with foods, you also have the actual nutritive value. So when you're talking to bodybuilders, a lot of bodybuilders are focused on simply body composition. I think this is where the sort of a calorie is a calorie thing comes from. Because from they're thinking from a body composition standpoint, right? If I'm trying to lean down for the summer or for a competition or whatever, then their focus, I mean, look, we should all be caring about our health and like the micronutrient profile of the things that we're eating. Obviously, 200 calories of Skittles does not have the same even compared to, you know, 200 calories of rice. You know, they're both carbohydrates, but I think people would recognize that the rice at least comes with it. You know, it's got some micronutrients that are coming with it. Or even better comparison, say 200 calories of Skittles versus 200 calories of a fruit salad, a mixed fruit salad, right? Obviously, with the former, you're not getting any vitamins or minerals. With the latter, yes, they're both sugar technically, but you're getting, you know, beyond the water, you're also getting, you know, vitamin C and, you know, vitamin K and vitamin A, whatever else might be in that. I think the conversations sometimes get mixed up as well, because you've got the sort of purely thinking from a composition angle versus thinking from an actual overall holistic health angle, in which case in the latter, absolutely. Even in the former, a calorie is not simply a calorie. Even we haven't even gotten onto the fact that, you know, it takes more, you know, burning. If you eat 100 grams of protein, you know, you're going to burn maybe perhaps 20 to 30% of that in the process of digestion. Whereas with, you know, sugars, you're not, right? You're just going to take in that whole 100. So there's nuances in it. But to take it up a level, especially, you know, considering time, I want to make sure that people who are listening to this, I don't want people to become more confused than perhaps they already were. So what are some basic for the average, let's just say for the average person, maybe they exercise a little, but they're not a bodybuilder. They're not an athlete. You know, perhaps they're not completely sedentary either. Let's say for, you know, from someone who is completely sedentary to someone who does some sort of minor exercise, the average North American, what are a couple good rules of thumb that they can just sort of take on board and apply, in your opinion, that are going to work generally well for the vast majority of people?
I think in terms of the diet, you know, most of the stuff. So to me, I always break it into two, right? The diet is the foods that you eat. And then the fasting period is how long you go without food. So they actually have nothing to do with each other, right? So what you eat doesn't dictate how long you can fast for, and how long you fast for doesn't actually dictate what you eat. So they're two completely separate things. But diet, I think most people kind of agree on most of it. That is, don't eat too much sugar, right? That's probably, everybody probably agrees on that. Don't eat too much processed foods, which is, again, probably, I don't think anybody agrees on that. Eat lots of vegetables. I mean, again, I don't think anybody really seriously disagrees with that, unless you can't tolerate it, of course. But, you know, to me, that sort of dietary discussion is relatively safe. So I try not to demonize, like, you know, fats, of course, were demonized for so long. In fact, the evidence that those natural fats are bad for you, that evidence actually doesn't exist, right? I mean, there has been huge studies, and in fact, the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, in its scientific statement in 2020, came out and said, well, there's a lot of natural fats that are saturated fats that are quite healthy for you, right? Dairy fats and stuff. So, you know, this idea that we should be afraid of fats in general, or saturated fats more specifically, it doesn't really hold true. There's actually very, very little evidence that that is actually true. So don't try to, you know, so no, you don't have to worry about that. Just try to eat natural sort of foods as close to nature as you can. Processing does a lot of bad things to it. And that's the diet. So that's not too complicated, right? Okay. In terms of total amount of food, that's a different question, right? And the point is that, you know, if you're eating natural foods, it's relatively hard to overeat them. So if you're eating steak, like, you can't just keep eating steak. You're going to get nauseated, right? That's why they have those, you know, competitions in Texas where they're like, eat this steak in an hour and we'll give it to you for free. You know, they're not giving away a lot of free steak. Like, they're not stupid, right? Because it's very hard. Because so natural foods have natural satiety hormones that will tell you to stop. So that's why you want to eat natural foods. On the other hand, The other thing, again, is just make sure that you have a period of fasting, because you know, when you're eating, you're taking in calories, you're storing calories for the most part. If you're not eating, that is fasting, then you're going to use those calories. So you need to keep those in balance. And that was, to me, one of the biggest things, was that balance had been completely lost, in that we went from a society where sort of we had a balance, sort of 10 to 12 hours of feeding, 12 to 14 hours of fasting. That's fine. In the 70s, people are eating white bread, right? People are eating strawberry jam and Oreo cookies and ice cream. But they still have a period of fasting where they're going to allow their bodies to use up those calories, right? So you have to keep that in balance. And that balance has completely been lost. And worse, you know, before this sort of recent popularity, people wanted it to get worse. People wanted you to eat more. And again, probably because of all the studies that were financed by the snack food companies, right? And that's where the pushback has been very good, to say that, hey, we're just trying to look for balance here, right? We want you to feed. When you feed, you store calories. When you fast, you burn calories. You want to keep those in relative balance. And that's going to go a long way, I think, in terms of keeping you, you know, at a healthy weight, trying to keep away chronic diseases. And yeah, you can get into the nuances of, you know, calories and hormones and all that stuff. But again, you don't have to, right? Just keep those sort of very simple, simple sort of principles in mind. And the funny part, of course, is that your grandmother could have told you exactly that, right? And she could have told you, don't eat junk food. Yeah. Don't eat processed foods. Don't
snack eating all the time.
cut out the sugar, right?
Yeah.
Come on. Like, your grandmother knew all of that with no scientific treatment, you know, no scientific training. And you don't have to go into the nuances of, you know, calories. You know, what are the hormones and what are the calories and are these important? It's like, you just get into, you know, it's making it too complex. People are just making it too complicated. And it's the same thing with the fasting, right? So if you now are in a situation where you have too much sugar, such as with type 2 diabetes, then what are you going to do? Are you going to feed more or are you going to fast more, right? Well, obviously, the right answer is you fast more, because that's where you're going to use more of your body's stored sugar. So that's going to work, as opposed to the answer that almost everybody gave, you know, 3 years ago, which you should feed more if you have type 2 diabetes, right? And this was the advice people gave, like, eat six times a day. It's like, so you're going to put sugar in your body six times a day. That's your answer to having too much sugar, right? Like, yeah. That doesn't make any sense. So I think those are very simple rules. And I think we sort of all agree on the dietary part. Like, there's some nuances that go here and there. And I'm not, you know, and that's always an interesting debate. It gets a little rancorous sometimes. But, you know, to me, it's still relatively minor compared to the general guiding principles. Don't eat too much sugar. Don't eat too much processed foods. And don't eat all the time. That's basically it. Even the carbohydrates, I'm not, like, you know, that, like, people, carbohydrates, I think processed carbohydrates are still relatively fattening, but there were huge populations of people who maintained fairly healthy body mass indexes on high carbohydrate diets, right?
Oh, China, for sure.
In the 1980s, Japan.
Yeah, I was going to say that there, I was going to say there still are.
Yeah, there still are. I mean, yeah. Japan still has a relatively high carbohydrate consumption, proportionally. The amount of food they eat is tiny.
Yeah.
You know, it's so they keep it in check there. But, you know, they're eating like noodles and rice and so on, right? So you know, those are valid observations. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, if you just take the sort of general principles, avoiding those sort of processed foods and stuff and sugar and eating all the time, that just gets you most of the way to where you need to go.
Yeah, those are valuable. The ones I tell people often are, if it grows, eat it, right? Like, if it grows, yeah. Or if your ancestors would recognize it as food, then it's probably you know, there might be exceptions, but it's probably generally going to be good for you and nutritious. And then, yeah, also not eating all the time. And for people, by the way, for any listeners here who are afraid of fasting, who the term sounds sort of crazy to them, or they're imagining that they need to be out in the desert for 40 days or 40 nights or whatever. When we say a 12 hour fast, for example, that simply means not eating between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. or 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. Like that's a 12 hour fast. I think people always forget the sleeping part. So whenever yeah. when I think people often forget that the overnight is part of this. So when I say that I fast for 16 hours most days, when I say that to people, they're like, what? Like, whoa, like every single day, like that sounds crazy. And I'm like, that really just means that, I mean, I eat between like 11 and 7 yeah, or between yeah. 12 and it's, 8 or between 10 and 6. And then outside of that, I'm not eating late at night, and I'm not eating early in the morning or in morning at all. And your body adapts to that very quickly. If that's a struggle for you, like I said, I think someone should just start with it. Just try 12 hours. Anyone, 12 hours is a breeze. Like if you can't do 12, yeah, 12 hours is very easy. And then you'll find you can easily push that to 14 or 16. And then, you know, as you mentioned in your book, if someone wants to experiment with, you know, 24 hour fast or a multiple day fast, my mom does multiple day fasts several times a year, probably several times a month at this point. I personally have never done it. I probably will at some point just to sort of see what happens, but I'm also super active and I'm always traveling and this and that. So for someone like myself, it might not be as optimal as it is for some people, but I'm a big fan of just starting, just like I'd recommend with the gym. You know, if someone's going to the gym, start with the small weights, you start with the basics and you work your way up. You know, if you've never fasted before, start with 12 or 14 hours. Don't start with 12 or 14 days.
And just recognize that the human body is quite an incredible sort of machine, right? Mm. So if you don't eat, as long as you have body fat,
you'll be okay.
Your body will figure it out, right? Because I remember years ago, you know, this was when I was younger, and this is sort of in the 80s, 90s, and you'd eat this big meal at like Thanksgiving or something, right? Thanksgiving dinner. You have this giant meal. And then the next day, everybody's like, oh, we're not going to eat breakfast or lunch because everybody's just full, right? So that's fine. Everybody was perfectly fine with that because, of course, everybody's like, yeah, we had like, you know, all this food. So we're just going to sort of just let it burn down, right? And it was just sort of natural. And that wound up being like, oh, well, after you eat this enormous Thanksgiving dinner, the next day at 7 a.m., you couldn't take 20 steps before you had to shove a muffin in your mouth because it was really unhealthy to skip breakfast, right? And it's like, no, your body is going to figure it out. Your body is basically telling you, you ate way too much last night. You mm-hmm. can go for a little bit longer, right? And so we went from thinking that we think our body is so stupid that we need to manually override it, you know, and shove that muffin down because otherwise we're going to have a heart attack. It's like, yeah, but you ate like three, you know, we ate like three times our normal meal, the meal before, like we can go a little longer. So don't be worried about it, right? The body has just an incredible capacity to sort of figure things out, right? And all you're doing when you're fasting is letting your body use its stored energy. That's all you're doing. That's all it is. Your body fat, it's not there for looks. It's there for you as a store of calories. So let your body use it. And don't worry about it so much, right? So if you can do it and it's, you know, easy or you're able to do it, then go ahead. Your body will figure the rest out for you. You don't have to figure it out.
Yes. And emotional hunger or boredom is not starvation, people. It's not if you are overweight or obese, do not worry about starvation. That's not a thing. Starvation is the last of your concerns. If you are fasting, yes, you will get emotionally hungry. You'll get boredom hungry. You'll get my body is used to eating at this time, so I have a food craving hungry. But that's not real hunger. This is another thing that you'll learn if you fast. You will learn what the difference between real hunger and emotional hunger. And I think that most people have been running for the past several decades, never having actually experienced genuine hunger. And so they literally don't even know that they can't tell the difference anymore. So they'll feel, oh, well, I'm hungry. So therefore I'm going to starve if I don't eat in the next few hours. And it's like, No, you're not.
I'll tell you that, I think the psychological hunger is actually a much, much, much bigger problem than the actual physical hunger. The physical hunger, I think anybody can handle, truthfully. The psychological hunger is a bitch. Like, it's tough. And I think it's tougher now because you walk down the street and everywhere you look, there's food. There's food on TV. There's food here. There's food, you know, you have an office meeting. Somebody orders food, right? You have a lunch meeting because they think while you're meeting, you need to eat, right? So that sort of, you know, the physical hunger, I think, is sort of like 20% of the problem. The psychological hunger and, you know, the temptation that it sort of presents is more the problem than anything else. And you get to know that as you start fasting, that, hey, you know, you start thinking about these things and you start realizing that it's like, hey, I'm not actually physically hungry, but the urge to eat this is very, very high because it smells good and it's right here. Right. So it's, you know, you bring up a really important point, which is that you have to differentiate between the two because, but recognize that the psychological hunger, I think it's a much worse problem to deal with.
Absolutely. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. As I said, one more time, thank you for your work. Thank you from my parents as well. I told them that I was going to be speaking to you and they were very excited and they explicitly said that they want me to tell you thank you from them. You've helped to change their lives and change their help for the better with your books. So, and I'm sure that's the case for thousands, if not millions of people around the world. So thanks for all the work that you do and please continue to speak the truth.
Thank you so much, Izabi. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. And before we wrap up, is there anywhere you would like to direct people if they'd like to follow you on social media or anything else?
You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Dr. That's Dr. Jason Fung, or Instagram, or on YouTube. You can look under Jason Fung. I have a lot of videos on fasting covering sort of different topics about fasting and nutrition in general. So that's always there available if you want to have a look.
Awesome. Dr. Jason Fung, thanks for coming on the Real Talk with Zuby podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.